Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, Karen Bloomquist is speaking on seeking peace in the world. So let's listen in on Karen.
And what I want to give some attention to now, and I realize most of you have not had a chance to see this, and there aren't enough copies to go around, but what I'm going to be focusing on is what is a first draft of a social statement called Peace, God's Gift, Our Calling. In the ELCA, the process of developing social statements is typically a 2 to 3 year process. And this particular first draft was put together by a task force that's been meeting for about 2 years, including people from this part of the country. Dan Erlander, for example, is on the task force, and he's certainly well known in a lot of Holden Village circles, and a variety of other people. I think one of the things to note about this is the diversity of people on this is considerable. There's a retired five-star general. There's a number of people who work in the area of political theory, international relations, people of a pacifist persuasion, people who are very much operating out of the just war tradition, people with a variety of different experiences, particularly internationally as they relate to questions of peace. So I'm going to highlight some of the things that the statement says, maybe in the first 20 minutes or so. And then I'm going to open it up for some discussion and to hear some of the particular concerns that you have in terms of the whole question of international peace. What do you think are some of the critical questions, understandings that need to be a part of our focus as we move toward the 21st century. I think it's fair to say that the development of this statement comes at a particularly crucial time. The task force was formed, I think, in 91 or 92, and clearly one of the reasons for developing a statement on peace now is that the whole paradigm, the whole world situation of how we look at issues of peace and war has changed dramatically, particularly since 1989. What does it mean to talk about this in an era where we don't, in a post-Cold War era, where the primary kind of fears are not necessarily in terms of war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, but where, in fact, as the headlines make all too apparent, we're dealing with all kinds of wars within countries, or within what used to be countries, if we take Yugoslavia as a case in point. Certainly examples like Somalia, Rwanda, lots of places where the issues at stake are somewhat different from the kinds of issues that were at stake when a lot of church bodies addressed the whole nuclear buildup and all those kinds of issues in the 70s and in the 80s. So I think we really do live in a new era, and this statement is an attempt to provide some way of looking at that world from within the heart of our Christian faith. So let me begin by saying something about the starting point of this document. Because I only have about 9 copies of this left, I'd suggest that maybe every 3 or 4 people have one, so that you might want to refer to some things that I will call your attention to. After the session's over, you're welcome to take the copies, those of you who happen to have one. And there is ordering information in case some of you would like to get your own copy later. In fact, what I may do is circulate if somebody has a piece of paper, in fact, you might do this for me, something that says, I'd like a copy of the peace statement, and I'll take that list home with me, and next week when I get back to my office. Yes, that was sent to all ELCA congregations in the spring. And this is really, between now and the middle of December is the time for study, for discussion of the document. It was preceded about a year ago by a much thicker document called Peace, God's Gift, Our Task. In fact, this one is even illustrated with some of Dan Erlander's illustrations. Some of you have seen some of the work that he's done in the past. And so it expands much more the discussion. This is a much briefer document, the one that I've passed around. So either of these two documents are still available, either the study volume or the first draft, which some of you have copies of. So if somebody has a piece of, does somebody have a piece of paper that they could circulate? Okay, if not, I'll have a list up here that you can sign at the end if you'd like to come. Yeah, if you could just say, I'd like a copy of the peace statement on the top, and if pass that piece of paper around, and people could sign their name and address. This statement begins by lodging the call to seek peace clearly in our understanding of who God is. And so the opening section of this, which is entitled Peace in Light of God's Word, has something to say about the God of peace, how we move from some basic convictions of our faith to the task of working for peace, and then something about our yearning for peace in our communities. Let me just say, highlight a few sentences from this. God's resolve for peace is present in creation. All creation sustains the life God gives. Humans are created for life in community with God, with others, and with nature. Peace in our communities is a gift to be received with thanksgiving and a responsibility to be carried out with faithfulness. That really rings the two notes that characterize this document. On the one hand, peace is a gift that we receive from God, but peace in turn is also our calling, our responsibility. Peace on all different levels. This particular document particularly is focused on world peace or international kind of peace, but tries continually to connect that with how we relate to one another on a one-to-one level, how we relate in terms of building peace and practices of nonviolence in our communities, wanting to see that as a whole fabric and not only saying, well, those are the global issues there and most of us feel so removed from that, but how is it that what happens in our most immediate communities is a witness to, is a model for peace on a much wider scale. And that kind of tension is built in throughout this document. Nevertheless, sin disrupts, disorders, and abuses the gift of creation. But sin is not the last word. God continues to preserve the word through the law. Those of you who have a document, I'm on page 2, the bottom half. God continues to work through people, their communities, and structures to make earthly peace possible. I think this document tries to strike a tone of realism, of saying, hey, there are some important power realities and inequalities in our world that are at the heart of the lack of peace in a lot of cases. But at the same, so being realistic on the one hand, but on the other hand, not succumbing to the kind of cynicism that I think is all too prevalent in our world, of people saying, oh my God, I've got my life to deal with. You know, last thing I can worry about is all the headline news things that I see of, you know, war breaking out here and there, and I can't even figure out where that country is, much less why in the world they're at war there in this African country or whatever. And I think in many ways, as I was talking with Susan Brill just a little while ago, and talking about how this statement, just to get people to take seriously, is a struggle, because I think so many of our concerns tend to be, you know, well, what's close at home? And topics like family or work or sexuality, those tend to feel much closer at home than international peace. And yet this tries to make a case that, that peace and living out that call to be peace, to be peacemakers is very intrinsic in what it means to be people of faith. At the cross of Christ, we know ourselves and our world to be under God's judgment and mercy. The cross tells us that forgiveness, reconciliation, and love of enemy are essential to peace in all our communities. So it's from out of that kind of faith stance that we are called to work for peace. Then there's a whole subsection in here on peace in our communities, which ties in a lot with some of the discussions that a few of us were having yesterday in terms of a message on community violence. And there are, I think, a few copies left of that. I'm going to move on, though, and to give you a little sense of what the rest of the statement is about. The second part of it looks at our world today and the unsettledness of our world. Now, because the statement is intended to be something that speaks not just to 1994, but hopefully would have a shelf life of 10 years or so, in other words, it would carry us into the next century, it doesn't discuss the particular war-torn spots that are in the news headlines right now. But as I'm mentioning some of these things, I would invite you to think of some of those war-torn areas in our world, the former Yugoslavia and parts of Africa, and some of the questions of should we invade or should we not that are in the headlines these days in terms of Haiti. Because I think what's going to be key in the various hearings that are going to be held around the country on this statement in the fall, and I do have a list of where those hearings will be. The list is on some green pieces of paper on the tables out there, is to test this out and to say, does this speak in a helpful way to the kinds of situations of tension, of international tension and conflict that we're dealing with today? Certainly we could probably spend a whole hour at least thinking about all the things that have changed in our century. And this does a quick recitation of what some of those changes are on the bottom of page 4. How great empires have run their course. Large-scale colonization has come to an end, even though I think certainly the effect of colonization may be playing itself out in some places of, say, Africa and other places. Totalitarian ideologies and regimes have risen and fallen, you know, and yet the fact of the matter is that even though people, you know, greeted the fall of the Berlin Wall and other signs, of the end of the Soviet Empire with great hopefulness, war continues to be raging. Numerous wars, lots and lots of wars, and constant questions of, well, you know, should there be some international intervention? And a lot of those questions. I think in part, as a world and as a country, we're trying to figure out what is the responsible, way to go. I think that. You know, regardless of your political persuasions, I think some of that's reflected, you know, in terms of the current administration saying, well, you know, what do we do in terms of the stuff going on in Sarajevo and here and there? And the old paradigms are breaking down, and trying to figure out what is the way to go is I think a real challenge facing the United Nations and individual countries. Human population in this century has increased fourfold. Unparalleled economic development in some parts of the world contrast with unrelenting poverty in others. Science and technology have expanded human boundaries, both outward into the universe and inward in terms of things like genetic coding. And the fact that now, you know, wars can be fought, you know, through various computer kinds of programming, and that, you know, it's changed the whole reality of what we think of as as the technologies of war. And then I think we need to take note of how the interesting and disturbing role that religion can play in the midst of this. Certainly we saw that in terms of the former Yugoslavia. I was having to stop and think of all the different parts of it, so I'll just refer to it that way. But in terms of Christian and Muslim and all the rest, certainly some of that related to the rise of fundamentalism in terms of some of these religious groups with a kind of fanaticism, so that certainly we saw that with the Gulf War, the kind of holy war kind of mentality, which almost seems like we're going back several centuries to an era that we kind of say, through the Enlightenment and all this sort of thing, we've learned to tolerate one another. Well, there's a lot of stuff breaking out where there's, almost a holy war kind of mentality going on. One of the main dynamics that this document tries to identify, and I think it's a helpful way for understanding what's going on in our world today, is that on the one hand, there has been an increasing integration of our world, certainly through technology, through the media. We had a distant cousin of mine from Finland spending part of the summer with us, 12-year-old, and it was incredible how Americanized he was, because of course he knows everything about American culture through the TV programs that he sees and through the music that he hears. The fact that we're really integrated, the economic integration project that I'm working on right now is one dealing with an economic statement. We've clearly said the global market economy is what is pervasively different from today than even 10 years ago. You know, the integration of economies in Europe, certainly the NAFTA agreement being an example of that. In many ways, becoming one world, or at least different regions of one world. It may be that we'll have all this integration in the north, and the ones who really end up continuing being on the short end will be the countries in the south. So I think there's some disturbing parts of that, too, that we need to be alert to. But while along with the integration has been the continuing and renewed significance of our particularities, particular identities, certainly in the former Soviet Union, the way in which certain ethnic identities have been aroused in some new ways, all these different tribal groups in Africa that most of us have probably never heard of, and all of a sudden there's, incredibly disastrous massacres going on in the name of certain ethnic identities, so I think that's an important kind of thing that is. It almost seems like we're going backwards at times in terms of the emergence of some of these age-old animosities between some of these groups. The movement toward greater integration changes the nature of particular communities, sometimes threatening them with breakdown and at other times enriching their life. But instead of eliminating their significance, these changes often accentuate the attention people give their particular communities. People's familial, ethnic, national, cultural, or religious communities will continue to become a more decisive source for their sense of belonging, outlook, and perception of interests. So the way in which there's more integration and yet more of a focus on particularities. And then the whole tension, this is on the top of page 6, what happens in the face of this integration and the kind of modernization, the way in which education, health, technology, the media have in many ways been homogenized, and yet cultural conflicts continue to be common, that tension between culture and modernization. Last month I was in Mexico, and was really struck when we visited a village of people that formerly were migrant farm workers who had settled in this community, and really preserving a sense of their own cultures. And they were from different indigenous groups, and they were blending these cultures together in some very exciting kinds of ways. And it was a real testimony because on the one hand, that was going on, and certainly a lot of modernization and economic developments in Mexico. And yet, for them, preserving their way of life was itself the quality of life that they wanted to maintain. Now, on the other hand, we heard one of the government leaders who said, well, you know, those primitive folks, they should just be able to live in their culture, and, you know, we shouldn't impose all this modernization on them. And I think that's a tough, there's some tough ethical questions there of tensions between modernization and yet the preserving of indigenous cultural values, some of which might have far more quality of life to them than some of the way in which our life has become so commodified in our Western market economy. So I think there's important tensions there that we need to look at. So in the midst of this, what does it mean for the church to be a community for peace? I want to cite seven phrases that this document raises up as to what the role of Christians is, or people of faith, in the midst of this. First, in our worship, in our public gathering, we need to proclaim and celebrate God's gospel of peace. Remind ourselves again and again that the peace of God, that the gospel that we preach and hear, has direct ramifications for peace in our lives and in our world. Secondly, the church contributes to earthly peace in living the oneness we have received. How can the church, albeit in very imperfect ways at times, model or be a witness to that oneness that is there in the midst of our differences of nationality, of class, race, gender, culture, all the rest? Certainly also being reminded that, you know, as a church, we are a part of a universal church that reflects the diversities of the whole world. Thirdly, the church contributes to earthly peace by equipping the faithful to act for peace in their communities. One of the things we might want to think or talk about is, how is that or is that not happening? How does that need to happen in terms of the communities of faith that we are a part of? Fourth, the church is a disturbing presence when it refuses to be silent and speaks the truth in times when people in a superficial way say, peace, peace, but when there isn't, when there is no peace. In other words, kind of demystifying, you know, the kind of, oh, well, yeah, everything's nice and harmonious, when in fact it isn't. And at times the church needs to be that voice that prods, it tries to speak the truth, and might therefore be seen on the surface as disturbing the peace, but doing that because of the injustice that certain platitudes about peace can sometimes cover over. This statement, for example, says we need to denounce beliefs and actions that elevate our nation or any nation to the role of God, so that the nation becomes first and foremost. Or when we try to find our ultimate security in weapons or warfare, or I suppose we could add in trying to always come out on top or be number one. Or we need to challenge when any people, race, or civilization claims an inherent right to rule over others. Or when any nation promises a perfect, peaceful society through the efforts of self-sufficient humanity, when we think that somehow we're going to create heaven on earth, that we're going to somehow create the perfect society, or when we despair of any possibility for peace. That too needs to be challenged or denounced. Fifthly, the church is a reconciling presence. I'm on the top of page 7 now. It serves reconciliation by countering religious movements, particularly Christian ones, that preach and practice hate and violence, or by challenging stereotypes of who the enemy is, the kind of enemy mentality. We may not have the Soviet Union as the enemy in the same way as before, but you know that enemy mentality can be displaced and associated with other groups then. And we are reconciling presence, the church is, by encouraging imaginative solutions to conflicts. In other words, saying, hey, let's try this and that, not just saying, well, that's never worked, but you know, trying new possibilities. Sixth, the church is called to be a serving presence in society. It does that when it holds power accountable, advocates for justice, empowers those who are poor and vulnerable, and meets human need. And here it also goes on to talk about the church's role in supporting government efforts to secure a just peace, and to encourage there to be debate about what is good and right in terms of international policies. And then seventh, the church as a community for peace is also to be a deliberating presence in society. In other words, where we come together with our differences and talk together about these tough issues. For example, issues of, well, should we or should we not invade Haiti? You know, what are the principles? What are the issues that are at stake there? I haven't seen the newspaper the last couple of days, so I'm assuming that's still being debated and there hasn't been something that's happened that I'm not aware of. Okay, then the document goes on and talks about some directions and some dilemmas. First of all, that we need in the working for peace to remember that what we're talking about is what can be the most effective politics to see that, in fact, the needs of the interests, or the needs of and welfare of the neighbor are served. The welfare of the neighbor requires a peaceful public order. And so a politics of peace must hold on to both the realities of power, not being naive about that, as well as a clear sense of what is right and good, and seeks to bring those two together in the building of a just peace. So our love of neighbor obligates us to prevent war and seek alternatives to us. We commit ourselves to addressing the causes of warfare in structural injustices, particularly economic injustices is part of what this deals with. And then to seek guidance in the principles of what has often been referred to as the just war tradition. It's a tradition going back to Augustine, has been a part of the Lutheran tradition and certainly other Reformed traditions. There are also certainly historic peace churches who've really challenged that and said nonviolence and not ever opting to fight is the only Christian option. Just war tradition, I won't go into all those criteria, but include a lot of criteria of, is the cause justifiable? You know, is there a legitimate authority? Is it a last resort? You know, is the damage that would be inflicted proportional to the results? In other words, some calculations to say, hey, this has to be a last resort kind of thing. Unfortunately, I think just war has at times seen as more an excuse to go to war rather than holding the line and saying you've got to meet certain tests in order for this to be a morally justifiable kind of war. The Gulf War is a time in our recent those just war criteria were brought to the fore again. So on the one hand, this document says, yes, those still can be some helpful criteria. What I think is different, though, about this document, and was I heard from some people involved internationally with the Lutheran World Federation, is that they were excited because this also, in a very clear way, affirms the witness of those who, in the name of Jesus Christ, refuse all participation in war and believe in the establishment of justice on earth by nonviolent power alone. Now, for a long time, we've certainly recognized the right of conscientious objection or selective conscientious objection to certain wars. Certainly, there was a lot of that at the time of the Vietnam War. But this certainly does raise up and give more prominence to what one might call a pacifist kind of position. Not as the sole thing, not saying, well, now we're going to become a pacifist church, but setting that alongside the just war criteria. Those who allow participation in war need to examine continually the specific principles to understand how applicable they are in a given situation. So that, I think, is a general kind of position that is represented here, and I think reflects the diversity of the task force. Certainly there are people of a strongly pacifist orientation on it, but I would say probably most are not at that place or saying that, you know, are not at the place of saying, no, never under any circumstances is war justifiable. So there are four different tasks that this statement refers to, and this is the last part of the document. First is that we need to be serious, I'm on page 9, by the way, we need to be serious in fostering a dynamic vision of difference in unity as part of our overall vision of peace. Our vision is one of people of different communities deepening their sense of belonging to one humanity and finding common ground to work together in an increasingly integrated world. We need to promote respect for human rights and counter and transform attitudes that encourage violence. And here's where I think there's a huge kind of agenda. I mean, it has to do with, you know, everything from the kinds of toys that our children play with to the way in which we deal with conflict in the schools. We were mentioning yesterday the importance of peer mediation in the schools. All kinds of attitudes that are pervasive in our society that readily view violence as an acceptable way of dealing with differences and disputes. Our city streets are probably an all too apparent example of that being played out. And to strengthen our will and our ability to resolve conflicts peacefully. So there's a number of different kinds of things that are raised up there. Secondly, a second important central task is recognizing that economic inequalities, and especially gross inequalities, are at the heart of many of the conflicts today. How can we work for an economy with justice? And this says, on the one hand, that redistribution of economic resources is vital, but so also is growth. Growth is also critical to the creation of economic justice. We support policies that promote economic growth grounded in more efficient use of labor, capital, and raw materials. Growth should empower marginalized people and enhance their role in the economy. Again, I'm drawn back to some of the things I heard last month in Mexico where there really has been some incredible economic growth in recent years, particularly since the last 80, in the late 80s. I think that's one of the reasons that the Prix Party was reelected. But at the same time, at least one of the candidates for national office that we met with last week, or last month, was very clear in acknowledging up front that economic growth has done very little to touch the reality of the 40% of Mexico's population that is severely impoverished, and that's what really needs to be given much more central, you know, attention. So in on the one hand, Mexico's debt has gone down considerably. There's been rather phenomenal growth in some sectors. But the question is, who's benefiting from that growth? And what about the poorest of the poor, who are basically untouched, or if anything, their plight may be worse? Some comments here about how economy needs to be ordered in ways that, on top of page 11, respect human dignity, provide necessities of life, distribute goods and burdens fairly and equitably, and are compatible with the environment and long-term global well-being. So part of this is saying there that also that there need to be just arrangements to regulate the international economy. This doesn't go in any depth to the whole notion of trade agreements, but it does acknowledge that new or renewed global and regional trade and commerce agreements are necessary to prevent wars among nations. Developing countries need better opportunities to profit through fair and open trade. And yet, having been through that NAFTA debate a year ago, we're aware that there's, you know, that's a mixed bag. There can be all kinds of downsizes, and you know who benefits and where, and which sector of the economy, which kinds of jobs, and which ones don't, and all the rest. Mentions the connections between our consumption in the U.S. and patterns of poverty, prosperity, and environmental degradation throughout the world. The importance of aid. Developmental aid, development assistance is certainly not a very popular item in terms of bills that come up in Congress. That's why I think groups like Bread for the World and other groups are important in providing a voice speaking to those matters. But this says we need to be able to provide assistance to other countries and proportionally reduce weapons purchasing subsidies, seeing that much of, you know, many of the weapons purchased in other countries have been purchased with U.S. dollars. So there's some things, it doesn't extensively get into some of the economic issues. And then the third item that this presses for is a politics of cooperation. I think what's different about this is it clearly emphasizes, I don't know if this is that different, because I think this is where many of our churches have been for a long time, but to say we really need to, as a country, work cooperatively, and therefore groups like the United Nations, other ways of bilateral, multilateral kinds of efforts become important. We recognize the witness and commitment of those women and men of conscience in the military who, in a sense, put their, not in a sense, who do in fact put their lives on the line. We support the necessity of the involvement in collective security by the U.S. Armed Forces. And we advocate participatory and accountable political structures within nations. Since in our unsettled time, almost all the world's wars are internal, the concern for political structures and processes within nations is crucial for peace. Situations in Africa today, I think, being a case in point. Certainly, one of the realities is the tremendous movement of displaced people, of uprooted people. the figures aren't in here, and I can't remember what they are, but we're talking about millions of people, and this was before the Rwanda kind of uprooting that was going on there, but people being displaced from their homes at alarming rates. The escalation of this has just increased because of, you know, economic and political and all kinds of other factors. How do we deal with that? Certainly we've dealt with it by providing a lot of help to refugees, but how do we also address some of the policy factors that are at the heart of that? How can we encourage and support lots of forms of nonviolent action? This also mentions the emerging forms of a global peace service that some people have been working on, to really, you know, work in other places on projects that try to seek peace through nonviolent intervention in conflicted and war-torn areas of the world. So it comes up, it deals with some particular suggestions there. The importance of reducing the arms trade, making communications technology work for peace, and a number of other kinds of things. I've talked a little bit longer than I planned on, but either in terms of what you've heard me say in a very brief summary of a rather packed full kind of document, I'd be interested in some comments that you have of what you feel are some of the crucial concerns or issues that the church needs to keep in mind as it's developing this statement. As I said, this is not an adopted statement. It's the work of a task force that members of our congregation are now reviewing and hopefully providing some comment on. But I would be interested in what kinds of concerns you have in terms of our involvement in seeking peace in our world today. So the floor is open to some of your concerns, and I'll try and jot some of those down to put into the process.
I guess a tremendous frustration can be serving many a church of the parish pastor to have gone through all of the bittersweet stuff on the statement on sexuality. You know, people just, some have gone ballistic, some have, I mean, it's just fill in the blanks kind of, that these kind of statements, which are also critical and valuable, go unnoticed. And then who would be interested, you know, to deal with this? And at least in my congregation, by a very few, there's been such derogatory labels placed on our church, with no awareness of the wonderful other statements that are being drafted and posed. You know, just it's the inequity of that is just sometimes very frustrating.
It's like, as our session the other night said, it's kind of like the sexuality kinds of stuff becomes the warfare issues.
The enemy.
I think maybe the part of the challenge is how can we more effectively connect these kinds of issues with the issues that are the issues that do grab people's attention, that are, you know, grab their guts. Maybe I'm not sure we want to do that in quite the same way on this, but you know, that really do speak to those concerns of the shape of our world, or are we in fact living through a period where, you know, the concerns are so turned in upon ourselves or our family or our immediate community and don't bother me with the wider world?
I mean, it's difficult for this particular congregation to consider their neighborhood as their parish, let alone their city, let alone the nation, let alone the global perspective.
way, the administration is kind of grappled with the whole area of peace. Conflict they had within the legislature, I find it very hard to believe that our church can come up with a policy or a statement that anybody's going to agree with.
In contrast to that, you know, let's acknowledge that the administration gets changed every 4 or 8 years, whereas the church should be the one stabilizing the government in the country to grant a statement of that significance. The administration has a hard time balancing the budget among the other things. Something of a moral issue, I think, should be addressed by the church as a more stable element of society.
I think it's fair to say that most of what is in here are more in the nature of some general principles. And the difficulty in terms of some of the particular policy decisions is there's some very, you know, things have to be much more specific. You know, for example, the whole matter of sanctions or embargoes of one kind or another, which is certainly a predominant, I mean, that's probably more how we're doing our foreign policy now than certainly than through open warfare kind of thing. But this document says the just war criteria also should be applied to those. You know, how do we think through, for example, the effect of our present policy on, you know, in terms of Haiti or in terms of other parts of, you know, of the world? And so I think the role of the church is not necessarily to specify, you know, real narrowly, but to say, you know, as our country is debating these issues, there are certain broad principles that we need to keep in mind, particularly this tendency to, you know, fall into this enemy kind of mentality or to operate in too narrow an understanding of what is our national self-interest. Because as the church, our concern goes beyond just the our own national boundaries. That doesn't mean we don't take national interests with some degree of seriousness, but at the same time, you know, the church's universal scope means that it goes beyond just narrow understandings of what national self-interest might be. How about some other concerns? What are some of the, yeah, over here.
I'd be interested in the discussion or any background on the topic of population growth. It's mentioned here, but it gets very little play. And considering the significance of this, of that issue to the very topic of the document and a lot of the other principles that come across here, it seems to get fairly little play.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I can say that much more, you know, about it, other than to say that's what makes the whole picture so much more complex. You know, particularly if one looks at that really rapid population growth in some of the places where the tensions and the hostilities are, you know, are the greatest, and countries that are, you know, trying maybe to struggle for some sense of democratic participation against enormous odds in terms of economic inequalities, and then the zooming population, and obviously the role of religion if one's dealing with a heavily Catholic country, and you know, all of the dynamics right now with the Cairo United Nations you know, the big conference coming up on population, and about the only thing we've been hearing is what the Pope and the Catholic Church are saying can't be dealt with there. How do we deal realistically with those issues? And in the cultural sensitivity kinds of issues that come in there too. Certainly lots of resentment if it sounds like, well, here goes the Western developed nations telling us how many kids we should have.
But I think that the document has a very tactful statement. It just doesn't, says aid should be responsive to the need of many countries to control their population through great opportunity as well as through voluntary, safe, and reliable means of birth control.
Right.
It just doesn't get a lot of play in the document.
Yeah.
It seems to me like it's an issue that's bigger than what the amount of attention is that it gets in the document.
That also was touched on, although probably not with any great depth either, in a recent statement on the environment called Caring for Creation that our church body adopted last summer, where the twin issues of overpopulation in some parts of the country and, in a sense, overconsumption in other parts were raised up as key factors in terms of the environmental crisis. Other things. Sven.
It seems to me that the lack of peace often results when there are big differences between people, poor and rich. Is there a sense on the commission that maybe we got our social statements mixed up and we shouldn't have had one on the economy first and then peace afterwards?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. That was a part of our original plan. One issue ended up looming so big that kept us from getting to the economic one earlier. But they're very closely linked, and even though the economic statement will give probably more attention to domestic realities, we can't do that apart from the global economic realities. And certainly, I think in this country, for example, the economic anxiety in many communities is another factor that causes people to say, well, I'm not going to worry about what's happening who knows where. I'm concerned about what's going to happen to the future of this community and my own livelihood. And so I think the economic anxiety permeates and affects how ready we are to look at other issues. I mean, I think some of the panic around the sexuality was not unrelated to a lot of changes in the social order. I was talking about this the other night, and the way in which economic insecurity can get expressed in all kinds of ways of, well, at least I want to have certain things nailed down. And if those aren't nailed down, then I really feel things are in a state of chaos.
I feel very concerned that the church, Christian church, corporate worldwide, and probably even much smaller entities, cannot be at peace with itself. There's a lot of internal conflict. We do not present a unified witness.
Yeah.
I read about the East and West Germans still having regular problems resolving their problems. And we cannot, you know, as our country specifically suffers the inevitable consequences of the worldwide economy lowering our standard of living, I think the Christian church is going to have to be very strong in promoting unselfishness and emphasis on less of an emphasis on materialism.
Other comments, questions, issues?
Do you have a follow-up on the economics? When you were talking about how redistribution needs to happen with growth, and I understood that balancing there. But the only form of redistribution that I heard mentioned was U.S. government aid. Are there other
No.
I didn't see that.
Right, yeah. That's because I slipped from one into the next section.
I don't think redistribution is very popular, though.
That's right. This does not really get into how that should happen, because this isn't really a statement on the economy. It's just stressing that there somehow needs to be some better balance between not only economic growth, but some relatively greater equity in terms of the economic, how those resources are distributed.
I guess my comment then is I think that people have a poverty of imagination about how they might give it up. That some examples might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rather than just saying foreign aid. And
rather than just saying foreign aid or charity. Or,
yeah, sure.
You know, are there some standards that we might want to look to
mm-hmm.
or be pushed towards?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is there anything in the document that we should apply in principle to what I think is a very dire threat to peace in many ways in militant Islam?
Yeah, it doesn't, I mean, it does mention particular, I read that one, there were two or three sentences there that I read, and I think that's what's different, perhaps, about a peace statement now than, say, in the 70s or 80s, the role of religion in escalating the tensions. And so the way in which religions can stir up hate and certainly, you know, an enemy, you know, rather than getting beyond the enemy consciousness, if anything, stirring up the enemy consciousness. And so I know discussions on our board, and I think on the task force too, have been very strong of saying, if anything, this needs to emphasize even more that reality. But it tries to be a bit modest there too, saying we've got to look at how that happens among Christian groups and not only point to non-Christian groups as the culprit in that. But religion, I think, can become a very powerfully deceptive vehicle for generating hate, which
well,
I think is one
start.
Of the, yeah, it's you know, an incredible kind of legacy there that we really need to watch diligently against. And, you know, and certainly the way in which then, you know, religion, you know, all religions get broadsided.
What is it? Christianity is a tremendously wonderful religion that it has ever been, it will ever be practiced.
Yeah. And that's where my own personal feeling is that this draft at this point probably still comes out somewhat idealistic, especially saying, well, in the church, you know, the church should do a witness, be a bold witness to that oneness, et cetera, because many of us know that that's far from the reality, and perhaps this comes off a bit too positively in terms of the positive role that the church can play in all of this. Other comments or things that you would hope would be addressed, some concerns, maybe not an issue, but you might say, well, you know, when the church has addressed issues of peace in the past, I haven't liked this or that or whatever. Any other comments or suggestions that any of you have? Well, I'm going to be around only for another half a day. I'd leave tomorrow noon. But if you do have some other comments, particularly those of you who have a copy of it, and would like to make those comments to me, there is a response form in the back of the booklet. I will leave a notebook here, and you can indicate if this is, even if you're not an ELCA member, we'll send you a copy, but particularly those who are ELCA members who would like to get your own copy and read it and provide some response to it, I'll leave a sign-up list here. Thank you for coming. Oh, okay.
Can I help you?
Sure.
I got a letter on my own.
Okay, I'll be around. Where's your room?